Welcome to Thinking Aloud,
a podcast about the nexus of all those things that make us human.
From the Lindenwood University College of Arts and Humanities, I'm your host, Don Heidenreich. Most Americans are familiar with Shakespeare and can even quote some of his works, but this is often where that understanding ends. How and why has Shakespeare become such an important part of our culture, and what does Shakespeare say to the modern world?
To continue our conversation on the importance of Shakespeare in the modern world, we have as our guest today
Dr. Anna Schnellman, professor of English from Lindenwood University, Department of Modern Languages, and Dr. Kathy Vozovich, Dean of the College of Arts and Humanities. Thank you for being here today.
You're welcome. Nice to be here, Don.
I'd like to pick up where we left off in the last episode when we were talking about Shakespeare by asking you, if you only had one more chance to watch a Shakespeare play, which of the plays would it be, and which version of that play would you choose?
I would want to watch Richard III, starring Ian McKellen. I saw the movie version, and I saw him on the London stage, and he was magnificent. And the Nazi-ish costuming and the setting, I think, really was a great interpretation of Shakespeare's play that was true to Shakespeare's intention, with the idea of Tudor propaganda all rolled in there as well. And I remember always having trouble with the scene where Richard turns the widow of the man he has just murdered, and his body is there bleeding, which in Shakespearean times was evidence that the killer was in the room, and that was Richard. And I struggle with how Richard turned her mind around into accepting him as her soon-to-be new husband. When I saw it on stage, this is going to sound really gross, but it was extremely powerful. She spit at him. And I was in the fourth row, and she spit. I could see it. And Ian McKellen, as Richard, wiped the spit off his face and very sensuously put it on his face in a different way, as if erasing the negative way that she spit at him and turned it into something that was very, very erotic. And the look on the actress's face when he did that immediately turned from hatred to desire. And so I think that when you look at the words and you see how she turned so quickly, we don't have a lot of stage directions from Shakespeare, but the words have embedded stage directions, as it were. And I think that was one of the most powerful, clarifying scenes that I had ever witnessed, and it was the best version of Richard III.
Yeah, I can definitely understand that, because we want to say, wait a minute, not only does she say that she's going to marry him, but he says, I'm doing you a favor. And she says, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And she knows that he murdered her husband. She's very well aware of that. She starts by cursing him. And I agree with you about that movie. You lent it to me, and I think I still have it, so I need to give it back. That's the only version of Richard III that I've seen. But sometimes those clarifying moments. Mm-hmm. I kind of think back to the movies we were shown in high school. The Zeffirelli, Romeo mm-hmm. and Juliet.
Yeah.
And aside from the fact that all of us girls were just giddy that we got to see Romeo's bare butt, mm-hmm. I think that seeing it produced really made it alive. But personally, I have a much more difficult time watching a movie than reading a book. It's hard for me to keep my attention on a movie because I watch movies when I read. And sometimes the way they're portrayed, I just can't follow where I consider them to be wrong. If I did have to watch another, or get to watch, I suppose, another Shakespeare movie, it would probably be one of Branagh's, simply because I want to fight in my mind with the portrayal. I really want to look at the book and see how it's being performed and deconstructed. But I would have to say Laurence Fishburne and Othello would be one of my current go-tos.
What is it about Fishburne's version of Othello that appeals to you?
It's the pathos.
It's because Kenneth Branagh's in it. No, I'm joking.
Yeah, he couldn't be Othello, so he had to be Iago. But the pathos of Fishburne, I think, really comes out clear. I'm not particularly impressed with Branagh in that role. It just simply doesn't fit.
Yeah, I agree with you.
But I think just watching the Othello character go through these changes of minds and these wonderments, it causes an emotional reaction. One might say a catharsis in me, because I could see how the poor guy would question his own leadership. He knows he's a good leader. But he doesn't know he's a good leader. And then when people shun him or turn away from him, he falls right into that. We know how that works. So that's a long answer to your question, but I do enjoy that movie. And Midsummer Night's Dream with the bicycles. I mean, really, it's all about bicycles.
Oh, that Midsummer Night's Dream with Kevin Kline from St. Louis.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Plain Bottom.
Are there some of the lesser known plays that people really should familiarize themselves with?
I think Richard II, I keep going back to that, is lesser known and it's magnificent. And there's a version with David Tennant that's incredible. There's also a version where, I can't remember her name now, I believe it's Fiona Shaw, who plays Harry Potter's aunt, actually plays Richard II in a role reversal of boys playing women. Back in Shakespeare's time, we have a woman playing the lead character, and she is incredible in the scene where she's giving the crown back. No, she's not. Yes, she is. No, she's not. It's an incredible tug of war. What lesser-known plays besides that?
I would say Coriolanus. It's such a bloody, ruthless play, and the character is so unapologetic that we get used to, in our culture, I think, understanding the villain. And, okay, Richard III is certainly almost caricatured, but we know it's a caricature. Coriolanus doesn't seem to be as much of a caricature as a real-life bad guy that we don't often see.
Yeah. Winter's Tale is another play because it's incredibly hard to act, to go from these scenes of incredible love and to turn on a dime to suspicion and distrust. But I did have the privilege of seeing Judi Dench playing Hermione on stage.
Oh, cool.
And when her statue comes to life at the end of the play, of course, she's always been alive, just pretending to be a statue. One of the characters comments, you know, is this my Hermione? She looks a little bit older. And he turns away, and Judi Dench just gave this little grimace when he said older, because obviously the audience knew she was alive. But just things like that really, really make a difference. But I think that is a lesser known play because it's difficult for the main male character to act well.
Okay. I think also The Merchant of Venice didn't used to be a lesser known play, but it is now because it would be extremely problematic to teach in a classroom. It would carry the same problems as any other anti-Semitic work or any racist work. And in Shakespeare's culture, there was a lot of anti-Semitism, of course. And I think it's important to remember that Shakespeare was a product of his culture, and he's not going to be this great saint transcending every problem, everything that we would find repulsive or wrong, even things such as bear baiting and what have you. I think it would be helpful if we could look at some of these plays that are problematic quite honestly and say, yes, that did exist. Why did it exist? What are we seeing in The Merchant of Venice that we also see today? What fears do we see that are also manifested today? And let's have a conversation. Now, that being said, I would never in a million years put Merchant of Venice on my syllabus.
Well, I don't think Shakespeare condones anything that happened in it, but to be able to teach it effectively. I did teach Merchant of Venice. I had a fantastic theater student in my class, and he wanted to play Shylock the Jew. And he played it as if The Merchant of Venice were a tragedy at first, and it was Shylock's tragedy. And he did a beautiful speech, "Hath not a Jew eyes," etc. Very, very moving. And then for the second half of his project, he was going to treat it as if Shylock were part of a comedy, and that play is classified as a comedy. And he tried to make it funny, and he broke down, and he said, I can't do it. I don't understand how this could be part of a comedy. And it was a very powerful moment for the class to see this very dedicated, talented student get so into the character, so into what he was saying and how he was saying it, that the impact on the class is incredible. And the discussion was, yeah, why is this a comedy? What is this? And so it had a profound influence on the students' ability to learn and enhance their learning and really do think for themselves in terms of what is going on here. I don't think Shakespeare shies away from difficult issues at all, but we need to be able to deal with it ourselves.
I agree. And that also, let me ask you a question. It seems to me, I'll pose an answer first.
Okay.
But it's intriguing to see which plays the students are the most resistant to. The most canonical plays. Again, they absolutely go crazy about Macbeth. They love Macbeth.
Mm-hmm.
They love Midsummer Night's Dream. They are pretty into the history plays. But one play that I personally have come to enjoy a great deal and find fascinating is Hamlet.
Mm-hmm.
And Hamlet elicits a lot of groans and rolling of eyes. And I remember when I was in high school, I got sent to the principal's office for opining loudly that Hamlet was a wishy-washy wimp and I wish he would die too. So I wonder, do you see any plays to which the students are resistant, and could you speculate why?
Resistant. I think that a difficult play to teach because it was un-Shakespearean, I think he was developing, is Love's Labour's Lost. And the students are resistant to the idea of how these men could be so stupid, for lack of a better word, but I think that's the appropriate word. In this case, in terms of having this theoretical, philosophical approach to life and what they can turn down and then make excuses for every time they break one of the rules they make up. It's a highly repetitive kind of rhetoric that Shakespeare uses throughout the play that's more like Marlowe, to be quite honest, a lot of stigmatia.
Maybe it was Marlowe.
Maybe it was. I don't think so, but that's okay. I think Marlowe was dead by then. But they're a little reluctant to get into Shakespeare. And when they see, however, that this is kind of an outlier play in terms of its style, and they can contrast it with a more typical, in quotation marks, Shakespeare play, then it's useful. But yeah, starting to read that play presents some difficulties for them to get into it.
I would wonder, with particularly the well-known plays, since there are some plays that most people have heard of and they've heard parts of, not necessarily all the soliloquies or all the various monologues, they've heard enough that they're kind of familiar with. Are there plays in particular that you realize, with particularly with students, that they come in with a real misunderstanding of, that they don't really get it until they have this kind of light bulb moment and say, oh, now I understand what he's getting at? Which plays in particular do you seem to run into that with?
Romeo and Juliet, they all think they're stupid and how could this happen? You know, why did they go to such extremes? But when they understand that these are 14 and 16-year-old kids who are traumatized, it leads to more understanding. But I've had students be very, very resistant to, this isn't a tragedy. They're just dumb. They get what they deserve. And as we discuss it more in class, they come to a different understanding because these are kids.
Is there any particular scene that
causes them to realize
that, hey, maybe I've been misinterpreting this?
At the end when all is revealed. So they focus from what they've seen bits and pieces of in movies or read in high school and grade school. But when we get to the scene at the end when you see the profound impact that this loss of lives has had on everyone and how it was a result of an ancient quarrel that was senseless, then they put it into a context. Then they can relate to things that they've seen or they've experienced, and they have more sympathy, not condoning what Romeo and Juliet did, but more understanding, more empathy, I guess I should say, of what's happened. So they have to make it to the end of the play.
And that also plays into politics, because when we talk about how our only hope is to recognize and view each other as human beings and not the other, that's another theme that is common in Shakespeare's play. I would say that the ones that my students often misunderstand is Julius Caesar, because you have the tragedy of Julius Caesar, but he's dead early in the play. He's out of the picture. So the tragedy of Julius Caesar, what is the play really about. It's not about Caesar. It's a little bit about Caesar. But I think Brutus is really much more the protagonist. And I think Brutus fits the classical tradition of tragedy as the inevitable result of a series of errors in judgment more than Caesar does. So I find that play very interesting to look into. How does the rhetoric work? And they all like Mark Antony. They love him. They think he's really cool. You know, the friends, Romans, countrymen, great speech. You could get it on a t-shirt. But then when he gets to the point where he says the mischief is afoot and let come what it may, and he has zero value for human life, and he's really a bad guy, that surprises them. Perhaps because, I don't know if they've seen the classic film, you know, the one to which I refer, where Mark Antony is this beautiful, blonde, golden, upcoming star. It's intriguing.
Marlon Brando, that
yes.
movie? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, way back when.
When we talk about film adaptations or literary adaptations of Shakespeare that aren't Shakespeare, but someone taking the concept of one of the plays, are there any of those in particular that you really find appealing?
10 Things I Hate About You would be one that students have made comparison and contrast to original Shakespeare and modern reinterpretations. There was one about zombies. I can't remember the name, but it was Romeo and Juliet with zombies. Only the student made a really compelling comparison. A student even did a report on Romeo and Juliet. Obviously not a tragedy then. But if you look, and that was not in any way, shape, or form a student who was trying to take the easy route. If you look at the first two acts of Romeo and Juliet, it's pretty darn funny. There's just that turn in the middle of the play, but acts one and two could be just as well fit into a comedy. So when the student looked at the cartoon Romeo and Juliet, she was exploring that avenue about, well, this is what happens if we continue the comedy. So I really like the thoughtfulness that some students have in terms of looking at, should I say retellings? Re-envisioning of Shakespeare.
For me, I really like 10,000 Acres by Jane Smiley. It's a novel, and it's a novel of Lear. So instead of the king dividing up his kingdom, we have a farmer dividing up his 10,000 acres. And I suppose it's not quite so modern. That book must be 20, 30 years old. To me, it really caught my attention because Smiley is showing her knowledge of Shakespeare and applying it to a very common modern situation. What do we do when we realize that we're getting old and we want the comforts of old age and we want our children to make over us and say that they love us, and then the tragedy is that sometimes they don't, and when you find out they do, it's too late. So I think that Shakespeare's themes bear representing literally in different forms and styles. And I'm not sure it's so much as a reinterpretation as a representation of the plot, which is not unlike what Shakespeare did himself.
Right.
Again, because his plots were not original to him.
No, he used sources all the time. And the zombie Romeo and Juliet is Warm Bodies, if anybody cares to waste a few hours of their life watching that.
It's interesting that Shakespeare has gone through multiple iterations of how he's been viewed, from being popular entertainment to at one point becoming highbrow entertainment. Has he once again started working his way back into becoming popular entertainment?
Wow, I think so. I think there have been some magnificent movies made that are making him more mainstream because I think his themes are timeless. We've got a Lear with Anthony Hopkins, which is incredible. We've got that older Lear with Olivier when he actually was experiencing dementia that I cry through all the time because he genuinely confused, I believe, in parts of that filming. So, yeah, and I would go back to Kenneth Branagh. I think he's made Shakespeare mainstream, Shakespeare according to Branagh, but it still has its good roots.
I would agree with that. I think students and people in general, again, if they feel that it's okay to enjoy Shakespeare, they're more likely to do so.
Mm-hmm.
But they are still scared of Shakespeare. And so I think that, is it mainstream? No. Is it likely to be mainstream again? Sadly, no. It was just a few years ago that Shakespeare was going to be taken out of our curriculum altogether because classes wouldn't fill, and it was retained because it meets a DESE requirement. I think that it's a wonderful thing that the classes are full. They're very popular classes. The word gets around, and the students say, yeah, it's really cool. You like Shakespeare. But we live in a world of bits and pieces and sips and lack of attention. And when Shakespeare's beautiful language is presented in No Fear Shakespeare, in our language, it loses much of the magic. Shakespeare could be mainstream, but probably among more of a highbrow crowd. That being said, I don't see Shakespeare used snobbishly the way it used to be.
No, I don't think it is. And I really like DiCaprio's version of Romeo and Juliet because you have the Shakespeare.
Oh, come on, that gunshot.
No, aside from that.
That wrecked
but,
it.
But in the beginning, when they're speaking Shakespeare's words, but the stops, the accents are all, you know, modern America. It sounds like everyday language, which is iambic pentameter English.
Yes.
And I think that movie goes a long way to show, if you read it correctly, it's easier to understand. You have to get away from this is highbrow.
Right.
This is inaccessible.
And so there are actually a lot of little YouTube things that break it down. There's a young woman who does overly sarcastic productions. She summarizes some of Shakespeare's plays, and they're only maybe 8 or 10 minutes long. I don't know who she is, but she's just a hoot. And so the students watch those little summaries, and that piques their appetite for the play. And mm-hmm. they have fun with the play, and I think that that helps a great deal. We've got to apply it to their lives. Mm-hmm. We've got to make them understand it on even a visceral level, I dare say. But I don't see Shakespeare going away anytime soon.
Does knowing it's open to interpretation allow students to feel more connected to Shakespeare so they don't have to feel like you have to understand it in exactly this way and it can only be presented in this way, but that, you know, that, hey, there's some ground here for movement and you can look at it in different ways and you can still be correct.
Absolutely. And that's one reason why I always have a list of questions per play. Do you think that Kate in Taming of a Shrew is being gaslit or is doing the gaslighting? Do you think, given the textual evidence in Henry V, that he is a bloodthirsty king or a Christian king? And so their requirement is to use textual evidence to back up their answer. But they learn that there's textual evidence to back up virtually any interpretation.
Since we're coming to an end here, going full circle back to where we started in the previous podcast, if you were to be advising a brand new American president on what Shakespeare plays they should actually see and learn something from and try to grasp the actual meaning, which plays would you recommend that an American president view?
All of them.
Yeah, and in particular, Henry IV Part 1, Henry IV Part 2, and Henry V.
Yes, agreed.
Because you see the evolution of Prince Hal in Henry IV Part 1 to Henry V. Determine what type of ruler, king, leader you're going to be. There is a growth there, but what does he grow into?
Right.
And I think that would be something that modern leaders could learn from. There's a time when you have to say goodbye to your past and your friends and grow up. Goodbye, Falstaff.
Well, Falstaff had to be killed because he was hogging the play.
Yeah, but historically, a different story. Hal could not hold on to his drunken partying ways, and he could not have a hanger-on who was saying, hey, buddy, when he had been crowned king. But then what do you do with Henry V? Are you the good ruler who's leading your country, or are you the bloodthirsty person who uses and abuses your authority?
Then I would add to those which are important several of the tragedies. Definitely Lear, because that has so much to say about the responsibilities of kingship. No, you may not do mm-hmm. it for yourself. It doesn't work that way. And I would also talk about Othello because a person who is in power cannot know who his, her, or their friends are. People in power are thrown under the bus with great regularity. People in power throw others under the bus with great regularity. Sometimes for no reason, sometimes for very sound reasons. And I think administrators from grade school principal to the president of a developed nation needs to do some self-reflecting.
I would add Macbeth, obviously, to that, because there's a lot of reflection going on in the play. There's the initial pride in overstepping to the extreme. There's excuses after excuse. There's blame. There's somebody, his wife, egging him on to be a man. What is the definition of man then? And so I think...
bare-forked animal.
Yeah. So I think aspiring to be the best person that you can be, being reflective and understanding what that is might be a moral from Macbeth. I would never teach it that way, but I think that's something we can look at Macbeth and understand from that play.
Well, thank you both for your time today. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome.
And we'll be back soon.